Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears along with you on this Tuesday, June the 2nd, 2020, exactly 15 minutes past the hour Eastern Standard Time. And we are in the midst of that month period after Memorial Day, which people consider the official kickoff to summer here in the Midwest, and the actual first day of summer, June 21st. But this year is a little different. The fairs have been canceled statewide for the most part. Certainly here in Marion County, it is canceled. The Ohio State Fair has been canceled. Fireworks shows all across the state have been canceled. But yet, in the midst of this, restaurants are opening back up. Business is opening back up. And we are in the middle of the worst pandemic in 102 years, COVID-19 coronavirus. How is this all going to turn out? No vaccine, and in the United States now, over 100,000 deaths attributed to coronavirus, COVID-19. I believe it's 107,000 is where we're at right now. What's going to happen? Is a vaccine on the way? We keep hearing the term second wave. What will opening the economy do for all this? Well, there's only one gentleman who can help answer these questions. He was on, actually, the first week of the pandemic. I believe we were one day in to businesses and schools and so on and so forth closing when we had this gentleman on. But he's been on the program many times, and we're so glad to have him back now. 2.5 months later, you probably remember him best for his best-selling books or being the resident doctor for the ever-popular, ever-famous Today Show on NBC. Always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones the legendary, the articulate, the urbane, Dr. Art Uhlein. Dr. Uhlein, how are you?
Good morning, Scott. I'm fine. I wish my wife had heard that introduction.
You know, Dr. Uhlein, I think about it, and I believe I'm right about this. You were the first guest we had on during that crazy week when things started to happen. I believe you were on, if I go back and look, before things started to close, when we just got the word that something was coming, it was bad, and then 2 days later it hit the fan.
Yes.
What have you made of the last 2.5 months?
Well, it's actually been a total surprise and no surprise at all. The surprise of it has been the shock of learning that we just don't know what we don't know about this virus. And the not surprise part of it is the fact that every single thing that is happening today, Scott, was predicted to happen several years ago. I have on my desk a copy of the book Deadliest Enemy, which was written by Dr. Michael Osterholm, public health specialist, a virologist at the University of Minnesota. And in 2016, in preparation for the publication of his book, which came out in 2017, he predicted a pandemic. Interestingly enough, he didn't predict this virus. No one knew this particular virus at the time. He predicted that it would come as an influenza virus. But then in this book, he describes in precise detail exactly what we have seen happen. He said in the introduction to the latest edition of the book, they changed only the preface. He said, these all came as a surprise. He's talking about all the pandemics, and they shouldn't have, nor should the next one. And rest assured, there will be a next one, and one after that, and on and on. So we sit here kind of in mild shock, and yet not surprised at all that this thing has swept upon us. People keep asking me, why does the information change every day? They change something they told us before. And I tell them, we've never seen anything like this before. There has never been a virus quite like this one. Yes, it's part of the SARS family of viruses, but it is behaving so differently. So when people say, what's going to happen next? I say, you know, we're really not sure. We've got some pretty good ideas. I can predict with almost zero chance of being wrong that there will be 150 deaths, 150,000 deaths in this country before we are done. And the truth is, the sad truth is, there'll probably be 200,000. We just don't know. You mentioned a vaccine. Will there be a vaccine? Sure. Of course there will be a vaccine. But will it work? How well will it work? Will the immunity it provides be any stronger, more powerful than the immunity from flu vaccines? Will this virus change every year, as the flu virus seems to change every year? Will we need a new vaccine? We don't know the answers to these questions. So when people ask me, you know, what's the future of this? I say, buckle your seatbelts. I can tell you what my future is. And this may be the most important message that I have for your listeners today, which is, we can't control that giant, large picture. It is so complex. But what we can do, we can take the steps that are necessary to protect ourselves and our families. And I urge everyone to do that. My wife and I are in our 80s. And what that means is if we get this disease, we have a 50 to 80% chance of dying of it. So you can bet your boots we are wearing our masks. We are very careful. We never relax our social distancing, because at this point, those are the only things found to be effective.
You know, Doctor, there are two big questions, and I think the audience understands, we understand, everybody understands, that all this is conjecture. All this is opinion to a great degree. Even Dr. Fauci, the president, all the it's just our opinions at this point, to the best of our knowledge. But the first question starts out, 102 years since the last pandemic. Why was it 102 years? What was that period? Why didn't we have anything like this?
Well, that's one of the best questions of all. And I'm not sure we have perfect answers for it. But I think it's wrong to say we didn't have anything like this, because we have had some flu epidemics. They have not reached the pandemic stage. And indeed, Dr. Osterholm, who wrote that book, actually predicted that the next pandemic would be with the flu virus, one of the flu viruses. And he predicted that because flu viruses keep changing from year to year. And they change genetically. They call it the genetic drift. And a little piece of the virus, you know, if you got a trillion viral particles, some of them change a little bit, and he predicts that one of those changes is just going to be lethal. And that appears to be what has happened with COVID. COVID is a member of this SARS family of viruses. There have been other small epidemics with viruses like COVID. But something about COVID is so different that it has just transformed the spreadability, if you will. It has transformed the nature of the disease. Everybody said, oh, well, we've got another one of these respiratory diseases. No, it's not respiratory for reasons we still don't understand. This affects not only the respiratory system, but the blood clotting system, the immune system, the liver, the gastrointestinal system. And it affects everyone differently. We've never seen anything like this, Scott. So I think it's really important for people to be somewhat understanding when scientists admit, whoops, that guess was wrong, because they are just guessing, and to be really, really self-protective, because we don't know what we don't know about this.
Now, the other big question, Dr. Uhlein, is when we all got panicked back about the second week of March and states shut down and the numbers went up. In the early stages of this, late March, early April, people did stay home. People pretty well followed what the states were saying for the most part. But one of the things that went on was nationally they said there were numbers as big as 1 million at one point. 1 million people are going to be affected. We're going to have hundreds of thousands of deaths, and it's going to come quick. And 70% of the people in the country at some point or another are going to be carriers of this. Here in Ohio at one point, the governor said, we're going to have, I don't remember if it was 10,000, I think it was 10,000, but 10,000 people affected a day at one point. That never happened during the closure. The numbers did not reach nationally or statewide, for the most part, maybe in New York they did, what we thought was going to happen. The hospitals were not overrun. In New York they were, but in other places, not so much. Why didn't that happen? Because I think that's led us to opening back up things at this point.
Well, in part, it didn't happen because we shut down. In part, rest of the country was successful because of the measures taken. But anybody who thinks this thing is over is smoking something that I don't want. This thing is far from over, and it is very clear there will be hundreds of thousands of deaths. Okay? But that means there'll be at least 200,000 deaths, and I'm going on the edge to say that. We're at 107,000 today, and there are 1,000 more people dying every day in this country. How many days is it going to take us to get up to 130,000? Just 23 more days, Scott. Will it decline further? Will someone in 3, 4, 5 weeks from now say that Art Uhlein didn't know what he was talking about? It's only 120,000 now. Maybe so, but if we are to believe the projections from the experts, if we are to listen to people like Dr. Osterholm, the message is really clear. This ain't over till it's over. Will there be another huge spike coming back this fall? We don't know, but we do know it's one of the possibilities. Will it go away completely? Just stop by July 4th. You and I'll get on the phone again, and you'll say, Art, there hadn't been a case in a month. And I'll be astonished, because no, it's not going to stop. We have a huge, huge pool of susceptible people in this country. And this is not going to stop unless and until we find a vaccine that is very effective, more effective than a flu vaccine, or a medication that just stops this virus in its tracks. And we've not been able to find such a medication for any other virus, so I don't know why we should expect that now. I pray for the best, Scott, but I think we should prepare for the worst.
Doctor, more or less now, we are into summer. The temperatures are up here in the Midwest and a lot of other places in this country. Businesses have opened back up. They have a new set of rules, but they have opened back up. Rules are being relaxed. People are outside. People wearing masks have gone down. I think 2 weeks ago there was a big story in USA Today that people wearing masks had went down by tens of percentage points. Because of all this, what do you think? Does the public think it's over at this point? Certainly at one point they thought it was going on, but does the public think it's over?
Well, I don't want to make the mistake of believing that the public is a homogeneous group of people who all think alike, believe alike, and behave alike. In fact, there have been and still are from the beginning idiots out there who gather in groups with strangers who expose themselves to the virus, and who may get away with it. That doesn't mean they were right. And there are people like my wife, Priscilla, and I, who are so fantastically careful about this. People are, you know, beginning to wonder, how did they do this for so long? And we're fortunate. I mean, Priscilla and I just kiss the ground every day. We are lucky. We don't have jobs we have to go to. We have family members who get food for us and put it on the doorstep. We are able to exercise cautiously. We don't bring strangers into our home. But I think you're going to see a wide variety of behaviors, and I think we're going to see, the experts predict, that we are going to see at least some more waves of this. Will the waves be as bad as the first one? We don't know. Will there be only one wave, or will there be 30 waves over the next year? We don't know. Will the waves be nationwide or local? We don't know, but it's a pretty good bet that they will be local. And it's just important to remember things are so different in Marion than they are here in Los Angeles. And they are so different here in Los Angeles than they are in Georgia. So let's not make the mistake of thinking, they got away with it, so we can too. Only time is going to answer some of these questions you are asking me.
Dr. Uline, being a medical professional, and I understand this for the most part might be an opinion answer, but in the beginning of this whole thing back in March, all we heard was hospitals were not ready, people weren't prepared, and we don't have the PPE. We don't have the masks. We don't have enough respirators. We don't have what we need to treat this. Now, for the last month, I'm going to say, there were even flyers circulated all over the country. They were circulated here. If you have PPE, please take it to the police station, the fire station, the hospitals. Those have all kind of dissipated. Do you think hospitals are ready now for a wave with respirators, PPE, all that sort of thing?
The answer to that question is yes and no. Some hospitals are ready, and some hospitals are not. The fact of the matter is this country is not ready for the next epidemic, and the reason why we are not ready is systemic. We have a system that is based on, a huge portion of which is based on for-profit hospitals and for-profit medical care. And even the non-profit hospitals practice in a for-profit manner. They cannot be profligate. They must watch their budgets. They need to conserve their dollars, right? Certainly the for-profit ones have to conserve their dollars because they have to pay their investors. So I would ask you this, Scott. If you were the head of a giant hospital system called the United States of America Hospital System, and it was a for-profit system, would you keep 100,000 respirators on standby just in case you needed them? Of course not. It would kill your profits. your investors would say, they're wasting money. Why aren't they running this place more efficiently? So our medical care system, at least 50% of it, runs in a manner designed to maximize profits. And that is precisely the opposite behavior you would use if you were operating the system to be prepared for the next pandemic.
In the beginning, the big story was doctors are going to have to make decisions about who gets a respirator and who does not, and that is life and death, and it's going to be an unbelievable thing. Now, I know there was some of that going on in New York in the beginning, and I'm sure other places it did happen. But again, for the most part, in most of the 50 states, that didn't happen. Is it still a possibility?
Yes. And I can tell you a story. One of our friends, Dr. Aaron Waxman, is the head of the cardiopulmonary team at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard's hospital in Boston. So he was overwhelmed, 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, dealing with people on respirators. And he wrote to me, and I asked him, what's your day like? And at the heart of that crisis, at the peak of their infections, he described what a day was like. And they went in, and they went into the locker room, and they put all their clothes away, and then they put on their diapers, and then they put on their hospital clothes, and then they put on their protective equipment, and then they worked 12 hours, and when they came out, they very carefully, in a protected room, shed all of their clothes, went home in new, clean hospital scrubs because they did not want to infect and kill their families. Now, I hope you noted that when I described Dr. Waxman's day, I mentioned they put on their diapers. The doctors and nurses on his team wore diapers and peed into their pants instead of going to the bathroom because they did not have enough protective, personal protective equipment to be able to change clothes. Does that give you some sense of what we were facing?
It's unbelievable, and it's unbelievable that that happened.
I was both staggered and not surprised at all, because when you're running a hospital and trying to maximize efficiency, do you keep enough changes of PPE for the pandemic, which only comes every 100 years and may now start coming every 10? Or do you maximize for efficiency? So his team wore diapers. That's Harvard. Harvard University, Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts.
You know, Dr. Uhlein, words have become a big deal during this. I don't think anybody would have been able to define pandemic prior to COVID-19. I want to go through some of these terms, because some of these terms we haven't even faced yet. But what is, in a layman's terminology, a pandemic?
It is an epidemic that knows no boundaries. Let me make it as simply as I can. If one has an epidemic, typically those occur with local outbreaks. You know, oh, there's an epidemic. I can remember the day there was an epidemic of polio in Los Angeles. There was an epidemic in China of chicken virus. There was an epidemic in Africa of Ebola. But those were pretty much vocalized to countries, populations, cities. A pandemic is one that sweeps the world. Now, Is the pandemic due to a change in the virus, or is it due to a change in the world today? And I would submit to you that it is both. If you have been in one of the giant airports of the world, I like to think of the airport in Amsterdam or the airport in Paris or some of the airports where we've been, where literally tens of thousands of people from hundreds of different places in the world are deplaning, crossing each other's paths in the terminal, and then getting back on other planes and going out to 100 different places. What you understand is that this world is a mixing pot, and it is impossible to contain a highly contagious illness anymore unless you stop all travel in the world. And we can't do that. So the pandemic knows no boundaries. By the way, I think it would, if I may, I would like to talk a little bit about that. That's how diseases spread around the world. But I think it would be worth a minute, Scott, if we could talk about how is this disease spreading here in the United States, and where is your personal risk highest? Could we do that?
Let's do that.
There was a magnificent article written by a biologist named Aaron Bromage about 2 weeks ago that swept faster through the scientific community and then the lay community than anything I have seen. I sent it to 100 people at least because it was just such an incredibly thoughtful analysis of where your risk was. Basically, his article was, where are you least at risk? Because that's where we all want to be. And he started out by pointing out that there is kind of a what's known as the infectious dose of a virus or a bacterium. So if you get one tiny viral particle and it lands on your nose, or you get one single bacterium that lands in an open spot on your skin, the body says, wow, there's a bacterium there. That's a foreign virus. Let's get. And all of your body's defenses in that local area come in and just swamp that virus or bacteria with inflammatory response, with antibodies, if you've had an experience with it before, and boom, they put it out. But what happens if someone with the viral infection coughs right in your face? I mean, you literally can feel the moisture, and you draw back, and of course, when you go, you draw it all into your lungs, and now you have just inhaled a billion viral particles, or maybe just a million. And the body says, oh my goodness, he just inhaled a million particles. Go get them. But the body's defensive response is not sufficient to overcome all those viral particles. And guess who wins? The virus wins. It takes hold in the body, it starts replicating, and boom, you've got the disease. So Dr. Bromage said, well, how's that going to happen? And he says, when you're outdoors in the fresh air and you're not near anybody, your chance of inhaling a million viral particles is somewhere between slim and none. But what if you're indoors? You're locked in a closed room with recirculating air with 100 people for 2 hours. Maybe it's a long lecture or meeting. Maybe it's a church service. And you're sitting there in the back of the room, and you're taking about 20 breaths a minute, which we all do, and you're paying attention to the sermon. 20 breaths a minute times 120 minutes is 2,400 breaths you've taken in. And someone a few rows over is breathing out 20 breaths a minute, 2,400 breaths. And with each breath, that person is exhaling 100 viral particles. All right? We've now gone up to 240,000 viral particles. And if they're just inhaling a little more, we're up to 2.5 million viral particles floating in that air. And that's where your risk is. So what Dr. Bromage told us is, A, keep your distance everywhere, but stop worrying outdoors. The risk is not outdoors. It's indoors when you're closed in with recirculating air, with and there's any possibility that someone in that group has the infection. So what comes immediately to my mind? Churches, restaurants, airplanes. Well, you're not going to see me on an airplane for a long time, Scott.
Doctor,
I hope people at home will just give some thought to that process because it's so logical.
Well, Doctor, and that's a big one because the grocery stores are part of this. They're thriving. The rest, I think they're all having better years than they've ever had. In toilet paper alone, which whatever that was all about. The restaurants, we don't know because they're just starting to reopen. But the industry that did not shut down, that took the biggest hit here, clearly, was the airline industry. Just check the price of a flight right now. Why is that such a danger? Why, you a doctor who knows how to protect yourself, why would you not get on a plane right now?
It gets right back to Dr. Bromage's article. You got 300 people breathing into the same air for several hours, and you are sitting there in an enclosed plane that is recirculating all of that air. Now, are you likely to get sick? Let's get practical now for a moment. The odds are that in those 350 people, maybe 15 of them, let's say 5%, maybe 15 of them have been exposed to the virus already because we're beginning to see that kind of positivity in test rates. So the question is, are they still in the infectious stage or not? How long can they spread the virus? Well, we know that they can spread the virus for 8 days, even though they've had zero symptoms, right? And 18 to 19 days if they have symptomatic illness. So I'm on that plane with people who don't even know if they have that disease. Is the likelihood high? No. But I don't want to be on that plane.
Doctor, here's the thing, because I know a lot of employees of grocery stores, department stores, and restaurants now are being made by their employer to wear a mask. But it's my understanding that the mask you wear does not stop you from getting the illness. It just stops somebody else from getting it if you have it. It doesn't protect you at all. Is that correct?
Well, no, that
or do I have it backwards?
Actually, that, no, you either way you run it, that kind of thinking, and I hear this all the time, doesn't make sense. If you're wearing a mask, will protect the other guy. Doesn't it make sense that if the other guy wears a mask, that protects you?
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think the thing is that if you're an employee of that business, they make you wear the mask, but all the customers do not wear masks. They're not mandated.
I would not walk in Los Angeles. You cannot walk into a grocery store without a mask. It's illegal, number one, and number two, they got bouncers at the door. You ain't getting in. Anybody who would walk into a business that allows the customers to not wear masks but breathe the same air as you do, you got to be crazy. The most effective measures, and this is being proven again and again and again and again, are distance. You want to stay 6 feet, I make it 8 feet, from someone else so they just can't directly breathe on you, and masking, even the simple cloth masks, not the bandanas, because the air just circulates right around the bandanas, but the simple masks appear to be very effective. One thing really interesting, that among the lowest transmission rates in the world you'll find in Hong Kong. Now, hey, wait a minute, Hong Kong's China. Should have been through the roof there. Why in Hong Kong are the transmission rates so fantastically low, so much lower than here? And the answer is that people in Hong Kong even wear their masks at home. They don't take their masks off at home. Now, why should that work? Well, the reason it works is it minimizes the chance that one of your family members goes out and catches an infection, doesn't have any symptoms, and now can't infect you because you're both wearing masks. It's just the custom there. They've been doing that for years. It sounds weird, but that's what they do.
So, Doctor, just like a grocery store, which, as I say, grocery stores are having record years all across the country, if an airplane limits the number of people who can fly on it, which I think they are doing, and forcing people to wear masks, which I think a lot of them are doing, if that's happening, why is the airline industry still taking a hit, and is there danger if everybody has a mask on and we have limited seating?
But you have just stumbled into what I think is going to be the real problem for this country for the next many months, and that is the psychology of this. Because you can tell me there's nothing to be afraid of, but I'm still afraid. And the research, the behavioral research, they actually did this in economics, the research has shown for a couple of decades now that people are twice as afraid of something bad as, and they will feel twice as bad if something bad happens to them, as they will feel good if something good happens to them. We tend to magnify bad things in our mind. So when I get on an airplane, I do not think about the fact that they're leaving the middle seats empty. I think about the fact that that guy six rows up and on the window, even though I'm on the aisle on the opposite side, he may be an asymptomatic carrier who is breathing virus particles into the air I'm going to breathe because it's recirculated. They don't open up the windows on the airplane. And so there's a certain logic behind saying, well, I don't think I'm going to get on that plane yet. And there's a certain psychology behind it. I'll tell you the psychology that I think is going to really damage the economy of this country and be so catastrophically hurtful to people, small business people and restaurants and everything. My wife and I, one of the great lessons of this pandemic, huge lesson, is how little we need to be happy together, to be comfortable together. We used to buy all sorts of stuff. We went to restaurants. We did everything. What we have learned is we don't need that stuff. What we need is to love each other, to care for each other, to share books and thoughts, and we just don't need those things. And my buying patterns will never be the same again.
Doctor, and this is just the counterpoint, this is not my opinion, but I have heard this, because we've started asking a lot of questions about what is the government able to do, and what is the health department and health officials of the state, what are they able to do? Now, here in Ohio, we have found that they cannot force you to wear a mask. Now, the business you work for can. The business you work at can force you as an employee, and they can enforce their customers to, but the government cannot enforce you to do that. Okay. That being said, we have been given the information ad nauseum about COVID-19. It has been the news story, internet, radio, television, newspapers for 2.5 months now. Now, if we open up the restaurants without restriction, if we open up the airplanes without restriction, if we open up all those without restriction, it's still your choice to get on there. And if you have all the information and you still get on, isn't that your own fault?
I respect that position to a great deal. But if you get sick, don't show up at my hospital and expose my employees to your disease. Don't come to my hospital and use up $100,000 worth of medical supplies. The truth of the matter is, of course I want you to come to my hospital. But I think it's important that these individuals who refuse to wear masks understand that if they get sick, they're not going to say, oh, I made myself sick, I'm going to stay at home and gut this out on my own. No, they're going to come to us for help. So it's really a two-way street. We are in this together, and I think it's time we stop looking at masks as political statements. A mask is not a political statement. Right now, it is the best protection you have if you happen to breathe in the same air that an infected patient just breathed out.
Doctor, I come back to this story, and it has always been the definitive story for me, but there are millions like it. But I'm just going to use it because I think people know the people very well. Nancy and Ronald Reagan, former president and first lady, if you would have went to them during their term and ask them their feeling on stem cell research, I believe they both would have said no. It's a bad idea. When President Reagan was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, he could no longer speak out either way. But Nancy Reagan, for the rest of her life, left her party on this issue and became the biggest advocate publicly, I think, gave more speeches, got more awards for being an advocate because her husband had a disease that may have been able to be helped with this. Now, why do I tell that story? Is that COVID-19 on a much bigger level? If your family member, if your child, if your husband, if your wife, if your best friend, mother, father, so on and so forth, doesn't have it, and nobody's died in your family, and you haven't seen it up close, it's not real to you.
Scott, isn't that true of everything in our life? If you're not black and you have health insurance and you have a job and your kids are going to the best schools, can you really understand what it is like to be on the other side?
Well, I worry about that because I think that what we just said, take all the restrictions away and people have the information. So if they get it, you know, you knew what you were getting into. But then I also think, boy, until you have somebody with it, you tend to be less cavalier. You tend not to go to fundraisers. We're very funny like that as human beings.
Let's not forget that this country was told by its leader that this was nothing to worry about, that there were only 15 cases in the United States, and that it would be gone by the weekend. And many people followed that advice. I did not. We treated this as a critically serious issue. Let's not forget that there are still people being told, not by our leaders anymore, that this is all a conspiracy, that it's fake. So My closing message would be: this is very, very real. Treat it as a medical issue. This is not a political issue. It should never become a political issue. And protect yourself. Take care of yourself. You do not want to risk the possibility of getting this illness. Could you escape asymptomatically? Sure, but it's not worth the risk.
Dr. Euline, you have always been a pal to me to come on, and I always appreciate it. Your kindnesses are much appreciated, and I'm going to call on you in the next month again, not as long as the last time, because this second wave thing, I think we really need to delve into before something like that may or may not happen. What does that mean? What does it look like? And maybe in the next month, we'll know if we're approaching that or not.
I think that's a great idea, and I want you to know that even if we don't get that wave, I would be happy then to explain why I was glad to be wrong.
It is a date. Dr. Art Euline, thank you so much as always.
You're welcome. Thank you, Scott.
There you go. A whole bunch of information. Don't forget today, Adam the Computer Guy at 2 p.m. today, Voices of a People with Linda Sims at 4, and the Pastor Spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker at 5. For this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
I did a routine about a coal miner disaster, and at the same time I did it, there was a coal mine disaster in Nova Scotia. He claimed that I did it just to have that routine. Take a note on my